On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles Megan Miller. The Westchester soprano is a rising star in the opera world. Susan Lewis profiles Hedgerow Theatre in suburban Philadelphia, which has been forging its own unique artistic path since 1923. And we speak with Francine Black and her daughter Tamara Black, founders and directors of Burke's Opera Workshop. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Beautiful women with big voices can be difficult to come by in the opera world. So when the Bard Summerscape Festival in Annandale-on-Hudson in New York needed one for the regional stage premiere of Richard Strauss's Die Liebe der Danae, the solution was a soprano from Westchester, PA named Megan Miller. She was best known for regional opera performances until 2 years ago, when she re-emerged with a larger voice and a specialty in the emotionally complicated roles of Richard Strauss. Now the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports on what may be an unlikely career breakthrough in what has long been regarded as Strauss's mystery opera.
Singers sometimes search for years to find the right niche. Soprano Megan Miller needed time for her voice to catch up with her brain. Though the first years of her career tended towards lighter weight roles and the personas that go with them, she now commands the kind of higher magnitude voice that inspired Richard Strauss to write complex characters who begin Act One in one emotional place and arrive in Act Three quite changed. Miller has already sung some of them and is learning even more during her multi-performance run in Die Liebe der Danae, or The Loves of Danae.
The past couple years have been really exciting for me. I'm in the middle of role debuts and house debuts. And there are moments when I wonder about my wisdom in accepting all of these things. But at the same time, this project in particular was very interesting to me. I love Strauss, and this is the repertoire that I've always wanted to be singing. And I appreciate the way that Strauss allows a woman to think on stage. And to make that the center of an evening? Very attractive.
Young Philadelphia singers have come to follow some pretty specific career patterns. They start at Settlement Music School or Temple, maybe landing at the Curtis Institute, or getting their final finish at Astral Artists or the Academy of Vocal Arts. Since Megan Miller did none of those things, it's no wonder that her Westchester-based parents, her father's a retired chemist who once worked for NASA, were rather suspicious of a career in opera.
I was a high achiever academically, and to be really fair to them, I probably had a new idea about what I was going to do with my life every 2 months. Like, I was going to be a writer, I was going to be a painter, a graphic designer, I was going to be the president. I wanted to be Katie Couric. I had so many dreams. And when I started talking about opera, they started thinking, like, that would be a waste of her intellectual ability, which actually it's not at all. You know, I was making Allstate Choir in Delaware, but how would that ever guarantee that I'd be able to support myself in a worldwide market of opera?
She went to great schools, but not the sort that routinely cultivate operatic singing, even though she ended up having more encouragement than had she gone to more competitive places such as AVA, the Academy of Vocal Arts.
AVA was never on my radar. I actually didn't know what AVA was when I was applying for schools. And I was also coming from Washington and Lee University, Lexington, Virginia. Wonderful, wonderful school, and I got a lot of performance experience there. They did an opera for me. They saw that I was talented. They didn't even have a music major at that time. I was supposed to be a journalism major when I went. And I premiered, like, students' songs, and I did my first full recital there. Crazy.
She ended up at the Juilliard School, won some competition prizes along the way, and was thought to have a Joan Sutherland-type voice. And though La Traviata came her way in Princeton, a junior Sutherland is expected to go towards bel canto roles, most of which are vocally complicated, but are more like archetypes than fully rounded characters. Her reemergence in Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos at the Vienna Volksoper 2 years ago went so well that it opened doors to many more unlikely roles, such as Minnie in Puccini's Fanciulla del West, which she sang at Teatro Massimo in Palermo. Later this year, she'll graduate to the Vienna State Opera for the title role in Strauss's Daphne. These days, she studies one new role while singing another.
If I start listening to other recordings and disagreeing with their choices, I know that I'm almost ready. Which makes it hard to work with conductors sometimes.
Onward to The Loves of Danae, which for many is Strauss's biggest unknown opera. Almost all of his seldom heard late pieces have been dusted off in recent years in the greater New York area, and though none have been hailed as masterpieces, they've gained many new admirers, just as many remained baffled and bemused by Danae. He wrote the opera in 1940, but by the time the premiere was scheduled 4 years later, World War II was in its final stages and all the theaters were shut down. Not until 1952, after the composer died, did Danae receive a proper opening. The aging Strauss had become fascinated with gods of antiquity, and in this opera, tried to have some fun with them, even if few were likely to get all the jokes. Even more curiously, the composer seemed to be sending up Kurt Weill's Threepenny Opera in the opening scene, where Danae's father is pursued by creditors. Miller's character was updated to be a sort of Paris Hilton type, a high-profile heiress, in a production designed by Raphael Vignoli, also known for designing something called the Kimmel Center. This Danae took place in Manhattan and the deserts of Dubai, and thanks to a kiss from King Midas, Megan Miller turns to gold.
I think the piece is hilarious. There is so much satire, and I think we hear kind of spoofs that Strauss is writing into the piece, because he thought this was going to be his last opera, and he didn't think it was going to be performed while he was around. And I think he just threw everything in there with no worries about how it would be perceived or even having to answer for it.
Even if she never sings the role again, or whether she gets hired by other companies because of it, Miller did something she believed in, something that used all that she had to offer.
We have to seek what's true. Otherwise, what are we doing? We're not going to become wealthy people doing this, so we have to do it for a reason.
Well, who knows? At least on stage in Danae, Miller is showered with gold.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Megan Miller is featured in the final performance of the Bard Summerscape's production of The Loves of Danae, tomorrow afternoon at 3 at the Fisher Center for the Performing Arts at Bard College in New York State. In March, Miller will be in Philadelphia for two performances with Lyric Fest.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
When Francine Black and her daughter Tamara Black founded an opera educational program in rural PA with a long-term goal of producing grand opera, some in the local music community said they were both crazy. That was in 2005, and since then, the rich musical resource they have created has become a focal point for opera in Berks County, has helped raise the profile of the art form, and along the way has silenced those early naysayers. The Berks Opera Workshop now brings successful professionals like Met Opera bass Jeremy Gallion, heard here, to the WCR Arts Centre in Reading to work with young singers from throughout the region and beyond. At the same location, the Berks Opera Orchestra Training, or Boot Camp, is giving young instrumentalists new learning, mentoring, and performing opportunities. I spoke with Tamara Black, now Executive Director of Berks Opera Workshop, and her mother, Francine, the artistic director.
It's unusual to have a mother-daughter relationship be the foundation for an artistic organization. You've clearly been a witness to all of her musical development.
Oh, yes.
When did it start?
Well, I think she came from the womb screaming and sang very young. I think she and my son sang their first performance. You were four, maybe he was three. So they've been singing since the beginning of their lives. I can't remember a time.
So clearly you were very comfortable with the idea that they would be singers, and you could identify that they had some talent earlier on.
I just think song is the property of everyone, and I don't think it has to be a career choice. I just think it is what enriches life. The thing is that my family comes from Europe. Through the World War II experience and prison and so forth, the thing that was very clearly known to my family was that song was the one thing that the Nazis could not remove. And so in prison, they sang. In prison, they recited scripture. In prison, they sang every Christmas carol, every hymn they could remember, every folk song. And so that's my heritage, my father as well. Singing music was part of the core of our heart.
So she remembers it that you were a natural. What's your version of it?
I don't know anything else. I grew up singing. It was as much a part of our family as, you know, dinner every night. Yeah. To me, it is a very normal, natural part of life.
So, Francine, when did the conversation start about setting up the Burke's Opera workshop?
I used to teach in public school and decided so many children wanted lessons, I would go into private teaching. As those children grew, went to college, continued their study, they would come back and study with me in the summer. I got Tam engaged in teaching. She's a brilliant teacher as well. And we did song recitals, we did all kind of things. Tam said, how about we do opera scenes instead? Because they're not getting that experience in college. It goes to upperclassmen, etc. So I said, sure. So we started with flute. Or no other thing. No, we did some Mozart things, didn't we?
Yeah.
And then she said, how about we just do a whole opera? So that was Magic Flute.
That's quite an ambitious thing to take on with very young singers in
a
fairly rural area. And so was there a pinch yourself moment, or did anybody have any doubts that this was going to work?
No, it was wonderful. We actually debuted up in Bethlehem in a little coffee house called Godfrey Daniels because one of the students had parents with connections there, and they opened it up for us and welcomed us, and we did four performances and packed the house for everyone. It was during Music Fest. People just walked in off the street. And, you know, as to the quality, well, they were very young. We had everybody was 17, 18, 19, and it grew. So they said, we want to do this again next year. So we figured out who was available to sing and picked an opera that kind of accommodated the people who were there. And then did a Bohème the next year. And it sort of just snowballed and grew. And as it grew and more people from outside the community have become interested, and it caught wind here in Reading, and we had some wonderful other artists and musicians saying, let us help you. Let's be involved. Let's grow this. And people being willing to form a board and file 501c3 paperwork. So now we are officially a nonprofit organization. And now friends from my college years who are singing professionally at the Met are donating their time to come down and mentor these young singers and help grow the whole opera company, but also to give back, as they have expressed, which is such a beautiful thing, I think.
So therefore, the standard of singing and the standard of the productions has gone up, I imagine, exponentially over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. We pretty much have to beat them off with a stick. I found what's really interesting is that youngsters that love rock and roll love opera. It's the drama, the high, edgy singing, the intensity of it, and they're drawn to it. And then, of course, they fall in love with the beauty of it. But yeah, the quality has improved. They found it necessary to study, to prepare. It was more than just come in and sing with what you've got. Now I need to know how to sing those high notes. I need to know how to produce those gorgeous phrases. They're listening to master artists. I want to sound like Renee Fleming. Okay.
Don't we all?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I think it has raised the bar for all of them, even the youngsters in our studio. The little ones sing in our children's chorus when it's appropriate. We don't have to talk anyone into classical music, let me tell you.
But the youngsters that we just saw in rehearsal had a remarkable ease with the material. I mean, are they incredibly well rehearsed, or are they just that comfortable?
They're extremely talented individuals. They've also worked very hard to prepare it. And I can say, for the most part, they have learned their music on their own. And we've put that expectation on them and said, you're responsible to learn your notes, your German, bring it into us and we'll coach it with you. But they have taken that on. They're really taking initiative to learn and grow on their own. And I think having a professional in the cast kind of puts a little bit of pressure on them.
It raises the bar, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely. It raises the expectation, and they really want to meet that. So they're working so very hard.
Francine, when you started this, how did you imagine it would be, and how has it been different?
Well, no, I thought it would be this.
Oh.
I dream, you know, I just dream of what it can be. And I'm old enough to know that things take time, and it is blooming and blooming and blooming, and the garden is growing. More than anything, I love this music, and I want to share it.
Your mom clearly dreams big. Has she dreamt bigger than this, or is this as good as you want it to get?
No. And yes, we are both dreaming bigger, I think, in terms of that we have two sort of facets of the opera company, and one is this mentorship program for the young artists, this summer thing, which is primarily geared to give the young singers experience. But in the winter time, we also do a production that is solely professional, and that's where we're still dreaming. I think right now that's a concert version only, but I think we would really like to see that be a full production.
This is the Burke's Opera Theater.
Yes, and I think our next goal is to see that be a full production as well. We're working towards it. That's going to take time, and it will happen.
And with the potential, then, that the youngsters you're mentoring here could, in time, be in
full
productions.
Yes, absolutely. And I certainly hope so. As they grow and develop and start to establish their own professional careers, they'll come home.
And finally, Tommy, you're closer in age to a lot of these kids. Mm-hmm. What's different about their experience, or what are they getting from this that you wish you had got at that age? Clearly, you had the same mentor that they had, but would it have been useful to people in your peer group to have had something like this at that time?
Hugely. I wish that this program had been available. I think one of the big challenges for young singers is in undergraduate study, very rarely do they get a chance to put an actual role on the stage. That typically goes to the graduate students or the upper level singers. And the sooner you start to get your stage legs, as it were, and you start to understand that whole experience, how that works, the better off you are to prepare yourself for this career.
Burke's Opera Workshop Executive Director Tamara Black and Artistic Director Francine Black. This Friday at 7 and next Sunday at 3, the company presents Mozart's Abduction from the Seraglio at the WCR Centre for the Arts, 140 North 5th Street in Reading, PA. Hedgerow Theatre and Media was founded in 1923 as a residential repertory theatre, where an ensemble company of artists and residents prepare several productions at once, rotating performances of these works. In its first several decades, Hedgerow was a hotbed for theatrical activity, and Hedgerow actors, playwrights, and directors went on to found other theatres in the region, including Malvern's People's Light and Theatre Company and the Freedom Theatre in North Philadelphia. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the history and contemporary mission of this distinctive player in the history of American theatre.
Hedgerow, nestled next to a narrow, winding road in the woods, is housed in a former grist mill dating from 1840. Audience members pulling their cars into its small gravel parking lot may be greeted by one of Hedgerow's principal players.
My name is Zoran Kovčić, and I'm the operations manager at Hedgerow, which is a fancy title meaning whatever nobody else is doing, that's what I'm doing.
Kovčić steps into a range of roles, on stage and off.
I deal with our subcontractors, people who come in to do our air conditioning repair or roof repair, things of that sort. I'm also an actor here in the company. I've been in over 150 shows. I design the sets and I build the sets with help and generally do whatever is necessary to help run a theater.
Kovčić, who has played Scrooge in A Christmas Carol and is a regular lead in the theater's summer farces, is the personification of Hedgerow's contemporary vision.
We don't create or build actors, we build theater people. So when someone new joins us, we find out what other talents and skills they have. But just because you happen to be in box office doesn't mean you're not going to be painting the set, or outside gardening, or helping to clean the bathrooms before the show.
In an age of specialization, This philosophy is an outgrowth of a long and colorful history of bucking commercial trends, a history that began before the theater in 1901 when architect William Price bought about 80 acres of land around the old 19th century mills and proceeded to renovate old housing and build new.
He was trying to build the ideal English village where craftsmen worked and lived in the same community. After Will Price, you had Jasper Dieter, 1923.
Hedgerow's current producing artistic director, Penelope Reed, says Jasper Dieter brought the same kind of idealism to his theatrical venture, which he founded as a residential repertory company.
And so that's what Jasper brings to Little Rose Valley, a company of artists who are focused on raising artistic expression instead of selling a show. So the focus in New York was on commercialism, selling the show, and here it was entirely at the time, how do we work together to make plays respond to the soul of the audiences?
The place drew other artists, like pioneering sculptor and furniture maker Wharton Escherich and his family. Escherich became friends with Dieter and built sets for plays and furniture for the theater's home, including a staircase and a large table that still grace the premises.
We have the hammer-handled chairs, axe-handled chairs, that he made, and he gave them as payment for acting classes for his daughter.
Hedgerow did new plays, it did the classics, and it did plays which would become classics, like Eugene O'Neill's Emperor Jones and George Bernard Shaw's Candida. It was not a money-making venture, but some of Jasper Dieter's risks helped keep it afloat, like its company of African-American actors.
1929, they nearly went into complete bankruptcy. His African-American company took a play that had started here to New York, made money, and gave it back to Hedgerow.
Hedgerow continued operating through the 30s, 40s, and into the 50s, when it branched out, taking shows into Philadelphia. By 1955, says Reed, the business was on the brink of collapse.
It was probably overstretching. It had gotten out of the repertory model. There were enormous costs, and they didn't believe in fundraising.
Over the next decades, Hedgerow weathered ups and downs. In the late 50s and early 60s, it focused on education and its theater school. In the mid-60s, a small group of actors began to stage plays again. In 1968, Hedgerow revived the residency experience. Then in 1972, founder Jasper Dieter died, and artistic differences split the company and board into two camps.
Half the board left, half the board went and started People's Light and Theater.
Despite the schism, Hedgerow continued with classes, performances, and a residency program, still propelled by the spirit instilled by its founder. Like a patriarch, Jasper Dieter had created a theater family whose members would continue to pass down the lessons he taught.
My name is Lou Lippa. Many, many years ago, I can't even remember the year, but I came as an apprentice with the original Hedgerow Theater, meaning with the founder of the theater, Jasper Dieter, and I learned a lot from him. I learned how to look at a play, especially from a playwright's point of view, although Jasper was not a playwright, but he had this great insight on how to get to the heart of the matter.
Lippa, now playwright-in-residence at People's Light and Theater, went to New York, where he had three plays produced off-Broadway, and in 1957 won an Obie for Best New Play for A House Remembered.
But I began to feel as though there was no ensemble. But I had learned about ensemble or company from the Hedgerow Theater, original Hedgerow Theater, when I was an apprentice here. So I missed it, and I came back to Philadelphia and so on.
Even in its tumultuous later years, Hedgerow drew young actors, like Susan Wayfull, who's been there since 1978. It was Hedgerow's Rose Schulman, visiting Boston University to teach acting, who made the connection with her.
I heard all about Hedgerow, and I wanted to be there and just sit across the table from Rose and watch her eat, because I just felt like this is where I needed to be. So when I got here 5 years after college, I stayed.
Jasper Dieter's theatrical progeny have kept the place going, even through crises, as when, in 1985, a fire burned the theater down to its stone walls.
It was very devastating, and we were out of our theater for 5 years.
At first, the company continued operations on the road, performing for church groups and using space at other performance venues like Bristol Riverside Theater, Newman College, and Widener College. After another fire struck Widener's Black Box in the middle of a hedgerow season, they decided to do shows in the only facility they had, the house up the road from the mill, where Wafel and others lived.
You could only see about 25, 30 people. They entered from the porch. We had all these actors entering from the kitchen. We had cookies and juice out on the porch. And we did that for another year and a half to try to keep going. I remember being in front of the Acme Frozen Foods with a spring water jug. Please help rebuild our theater.
Funds raised from the community, foundations, and government, combined with insurance proceeds, went to rebuilding Hedgerow's home. By 1990, the shell of the former grist mill had been restored, and Hedgerow moved back in. That year, Penelope Reed was brought in as artistic director to rebuild the company. She brought back the repertory model and worked to strengthen relationships with those in the local acting community.
We do equity shows. We also do intergenerational shows. And we have our schools. I suppose what I bring to it is that I really believe in the interaction between the audience and the actors. So that interplay is very important to me. It is not about the trappings of theater, all of the pyrotechnics.
Hedgerow continues to renovate, making the historic structure more user-friendly for the disabled, moving seats to allow for better sight lines, developing gardens, and opening up a new entrance on the side. The new improvements will commingle with artifacts from the past, like the charred beams which remain overhead in the front lobby, and Wharton Esherick's 1935 table, which sits in the reception area along with photos of old productions, reminders of what came before, the challenges, the triumphs, and the people who have kept the Hedgerow vision alive for nearly a century.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan, our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.